Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. After a four-day virtual convention, former Vice President Joe Biden officially accepts the Democratic Party's presidential nomination with this promise.
If you entrust me with the presidency, I will draw on the best of us, not the worst. I'll be an ally of the light, not the darkness.
Former White House advisor Steve Bannon arrested yesterday for fraud in an alleged border wall scheme. Here's President Trump.
I didn't like that project. I thought that was a project that was being done for showboating reasons. I don't know that he was in charge. I didn't know any of the other people either. But it's sad. It's very sad.
Meanwhile, in California, tens of thousands forced to flee their homes as forest fires rage. Here's Governor Gavin Newsom.
Hundreds of fires throughout the state of California because of this extraordinary weather that we're experiencing and all of these lightning strikes.
It's our week in the news, and we have a great panel to guide us through it all. Laura Barrón-López, national political reporter from Politico, joins us. Laura, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Elizabeth Landers, D.C. correspondent for Vice. Thank you for being here, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me as well.
And Karen Travers, White House correspondent for ABC News. Karen, great to have you.
Thanks, Jane. Glad to be here.
So let's begin with former Vice President Joe Biden accepting the Democratic presidential nomination last night. Biden stressed the message of unity among all Americans, regardless of party. He said that message would continue to resonate if he was elected.
I'll work hard for those who didn't support me, as hard for them as I did for those who did vote for me. That's the job of a president, to represent all of us, not just our base or our party. This is not a partisan moment. This must be an American moment.
Liz Landers, what did this speech tell us about this candidate?
Well, I think to me, the part that you just played really stood out. The part that Joe Biden wants to be a president for the American people. I think that's something that we don't hear as much from President Trump. He talks about his base, his supporters, them versus us. And I think that Biden really came out and said yesterday that he wants to be president for Republicans, for independents, and for Democrats. And that's something that we saw throughout this Democratic convention process. There was a huge emphasis on unity, not just within the Democratic Party, but across the country, bringing former Republicans into the fold for the Democrats. Something else I thought that really stood out to me in Biden's speech yesterday was the contrast that he drew between how he says he would handle the coronavirus pandemic and the president's. There was a lot of focus on the coronavirus throughout this convention. And I think that that is probably the right strategy for Democrats right now, as this continues to be the top issue for Americans across the country.
Laura Barrón-López, do you agree? And what struck you about Joe Biden and this convention?
Yes, I agree with Liz's points. I also, other things that stood out to me in that speech were the way he talked about racism, which is something that we haven't heard much from presidential candidates or people in his position before really explicitly talk about it in a convention speech. We saw that repeatedly over the course of the convention, where Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris named George Floyd and Breonna Taylor people killed by police. And one of the quotes that stood out to me in Biden's speech last night was when he said, he asked, will we be the generation that finally wipes out the stain of racism? He's repeatedly spoken about Charlottesville and that Unite the Right rally with white nationalists as the primary reason that he jumped into the campaign. But last night, his appeal to the country on this specific issue was striking. And it also hit with his other comments, talking about trying to be an ally of the light and not the darkness. So I expect that in the remaining months that he is going to continue talking about this.
Here is Senator Kamala Harris accepting the formal nomination for the vice presidency. In her speech, she also called out the nation's structural racism.
This virus, it has no eyes, and yet it knows exactly how we see each other and how we treat each other. And let's be clear, there is no vaccine for racism.
Karen Travers, in a summer marked by protests over racism, a real strong theme in Kamala Harris's remarks, and broadly speaking, what did you hear?
I think it was a broad theme this week coming up over many different speakers. We heard Joe Biden talk about this last night, about his moment meeting George Floyd's daughter and how powerful that was. I don't think it was an explicit policy proposal of how we can fix this. I think Kamala Harris, Joe Biden last night, and many of the other speakers were really speaking in broad brushstrokes about this moment that the country is facing and how Joe Biden, the person, not Joe Biden, the policymaker, can lead this nation, can fix this. I think some of the things I was struck by with Biden's speech last night was how much he emphasized character. He said, character is on the ballot. Compassion is on the ballot. Decency is on the ballot. And he referred to this as a battle for the soul of this nation. It wasn't a battle about policy proposals. And I think that's where you get into that push for a change for structural racism. Joe Biden saying last night, you know, we can choose a path to become angrier, less hopeful, more divided, or a different path. He is saying that he and Kamala Harris will take this nation in a different direction. Just that explicit contrast to what he says the president has done over the last 3.5 years.
Well, and then
Jane,
there was President Barack. Let me get to this clip. President Barack Obama condemning his successor, Donald Trump. It was a scathing rebuke. Obama warned that Trump is on the cusp of destroying democracy itself. Here's President Obama.
For close to 4 years now, he has shown no interest in putting in the work. No interest in finding common ground. No interest in using the awesome power of his office to help anyone but himself and his friends. No interest in treating the presidency as anything but one more reality show that he can use to get the attention he craves. Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. And the consequences of that failure are severe.
From the White House, President Trump was tweeting his rage in all caps in real time as President Obama spoke. Liz, this was a speech unlike any other delivered by a former president.
Absolutely. And we've seen President Obama over the last few months come into the public eye more with public criticism of President Trump. We've heard for the past few years that he would say privately to his friends that he was really disappointed and concerned about how Donald Trump is taking the country. This was very explicit and clear. And I think that some of this, too, for President Obama is very personal. We've had hints again of birtherism conspiracy theories this past week when there were people in the Trump administration speculating about Kamala Harris's ability to serve in the administration. That's personal for someone like Obama. I also think that with the Affordable Care Act being his signature piece of legislation and the Trump administration trying to dismantle that for the last few years, that Obama really came forward and said that if any of the progress that we've seen in the last few years is something that you like, reelecting President Trump is not going to get us there. And his wife, Michelle Obama, especially emphasized to Democrats and to the American public her belief that if President Trump is reelected, that it's going to get even worse than what she says we've already seen.
Laura, in many ways, Donald Trump built his political career by using Barack Obama as sort of a boogeyman, if you will. And Obama heretofore has kept mostly quiet, but he departed from that post-presidential protocol in a very big way.
That's right. There's no doubt that this speech this week was significant and a departure from what past presidents would have done during a convention speech. That being said, Obama during the 2018 cycle did start to explicitly call out President Trump on the campaign trail. And he also back then talked about democracy being at stake. So he has pushed against Trump when we've been approaching election cycles. And of course, after 2018, that was when the House flipped to Democrats, and he stumped for a lot of Democrats out on the trail. So from this point forward, Obama will definitely be one of the leading Democrats to watch in how much he's out there, how much he can be out there, given the virtual situation that Democrats are in since they aren't physically campaigning. And then if I could just add to one point Karen made earlier about that the Democrats' decision to talk more about character and to talk about racism rather than explicitly issuing policies. There's been critiques actually from Black Lives Matter activists this week who are also a part of that big tent party. And they are frustrated with the lack of conversation around very specific policy this week during the convention.
Well, there seem to be a lot of Republicans participating in the Democratic convention this week. Here is former governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich in an address on Monday night.
I'm a lifelong Republican, but that attachment holds second place to my responsibility to my country. That's why I've chosen to appear at this convention. In normal times, something like this would probably never happen. But these are not normal times.
Karen Travers, about 30 seconds here, but from John Kasich to Colin Powell to John McCain there, even in death, what did you make of these moderate Republicans crossing over in apparent support of Joe Biden?
Yeah, this was a very deliberate effort by the DNC and the Biden campaign to say it is okay to come over to our side, that you maybe gave Donald Trump a chance in 2016, but now his presidency is not a hypothetical. It's a real thing and it's not working. So you can join us this time around, essentially trying to say, you know, he's not the far left candidate. He's somebody that Republicans can actually be okay with and vote for him in November.
We are talking about the week in the news with Karen Travers of ABC News, Laura Barrón-López of Politico, and Elizabeth Landers from Vice News. Up next, Steve Bannon arrested for fraud and the long-awaited new Senate intelligence report about Russian interference in the 2016 election. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Much more to come. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week in the news this hour, and I'm here with a great panel. Elizabeth Landers, D.C. correspondent for Vice, Laura Barrón-López, national political reporter at Politico, and ABC News White House correspondent Karen Travers. Well, delegates at the Democratic National Convention cast their votes this week to nominate Joe Biden in short videos from their home states. It was a virtual trip across the U.S., 57 states and territories. They started in Alabama at the site of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, where the late John Lewis led an infamous civil rights march for voting rights in 1965.
Those who walked this path before us showed us the way forward. If we want to honor John Lewis's incredible life, let's restore the Voting Rights Act and ensure that our democracy belongs to all Americans.
Alabama casts 8 votes for Bernie Sanders. And the great state of Alabama casts 52 votes for our next president of these United States, Joe Biden.
Well, the roll call was interesting because it took you across the country into the territories to see Americans really across the spectrum. I want to play this clip to begin our segment here. Of course, a political convention is all about generating excitement and convincing people to vote. Michelle Obama made a forceful case about why that is important. Here she is closing the keynote speech on the first night of this week's convention.
We have got to grab our comfortable shoes, put on our masks, pack a brown bag, dinner, and maybe breakfast, too, because we've got to be willing to stand in line all night if we have to.
So Liz Landers, Michelle Obama making it very clear she doesn't like politics. But boy, from the necklace, the vote necklace, she was all in a big way this week.
She was huge, and we've seen there are so many polls that show that Michelle Obama is such a popular figure in American life. So it makes sense that the Democratic National Convention would showcase her in such a big way, and she really used that platform. I think that a lot of people have made the observation that because this convention was virtual, a lot of the pomp and circumstance was eliminated, but that also sort of heightened the gravity and made people really sit down and watch the TV screen and listen to what the message was. And as you said, even, you know, from her vote necklace, from what she was wearing to what she was saying, she was making herself extremely clear that she thinks that Donald Trump is a dangerous man, is a dangerous president, is not reflecting the values of America, and then spoke to the character, as Karen and Laura were saying earlier, the character of Joe Biden. And she knows him. She knows him personally. So she was able to speak to that as well in a speech that I think was well received and was quite powerful.
And with all the controversy about mail-in voting and President Trump's attacks on it, what was striking to me is to hear from Michelle Obama and others over and over that you don't just have to vote, you have to have a plan to vote. Laura, lots of convention speakers giving a number for people to text the Biden campaign to help with your ballot and what are the deadlines and all of that, which was very interesting, Laura, to me.
Yes, Democrats weren't just saying go vote, as we've heard in the past. They were saying there are going to be obstacles, and they were acknowledging past elections where there has been voter suppression, which disproportionately impacts people of color, particularly Black people, and that there, if there are going to be obstacles, bring snacks. I think Michelle Obama said something to that effect, too. Bring, you know, comfortable shoes, because you may be standing in line for a long time if you don't cast your vote by mail. And if you do plan to vote by mail, last night at the during the last night of the convention, some other speakers also said, make sure that you cast that mail ballot early. Don't wait until the last minute, given the delays that seem to be affecting almost every state across the country in terms of the U.S. Postal Service. So they weren't just saying vote. They were saying that voters need to be prepared for the many obstacles that they face due to the pandemic and also due to potential voter suppression.
Well, in the Democratic Party platform, there seemed to be a little something for everyone, combating the climate crisis, creating a 21st century immigration system, a world-class education for everyone. Karen Travers, what did you make of this sort of grab bag approach, if you will?
Yeah, I think they're trying to appeal to the various groups in the Democratic Party. You know, this was a primary fight where Joe Biden was not the candidate for progressive supporters, for progressive voters. And I think they had to acknowledge the wants and needs of that group of the Democratic Party. So you certainly saw Joe Biden last night talking about climate change right at the top of his speech, saying it's one of the key crises facing this nation right now, putting it up there with the fight for racial justice, the coronavirus pandemic, and the economic crisis. I thought that was interesting that he had that in his top four. You had Bernie Sanders giving remarks this week. You had various rivals of Joe Biden's. I think they were trying to show this front of unity that there were a lot of questions about during the primary season. I mean, remember a couple months ago, we were talking about the potential for a contested convention. That all went away very quickly. So it is notable how much more united the Democratic Party was trying to present itself as. Of course, there's still some issues. There were progressives who were not happy with enough focus on climate issues. They wanted to hear more on that. They wanted to hear more from the speakers that they were pushing for. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had a very, very brief role the other night. People wanted to hear more from her. But I think, again, as we've all kind of said this over the last few minutes, that this was all about Joe Biden. This was all about defeating Donald Trump. And I think that they were trying to keep the focus on that instead of any potential fissures within the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, Democratic pollster Peter Hart said something very interesting this week. He said Biden is well known, but not known well. That from a Democratic pollster. So a real challenge, he was suggesting, for Biden to make the pitch for himself. You know, he's laid out an ambitious suite of plans, but it's not entirely clear how many voters know exactly what those are, Liz.
Yes, and that was something that we learned more about Joe Biden throughout the week. I think introducing the American public to his personal story is powerful. He has overcome a huge number of losses in his life, starting with the loss of his wife and daughter years and years ago to the most recent loss of his son, Beau. But there were things sprinkled throughout the DNC programming that talked about his achievements when he was in the Senate and signature pieces of legislation. One of those is VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, that has now stalled in Congress. I think that is a piece of legislation that Biden is very proud of to help women who are domestic abuse survivors. Another thing was the assault weapons ban, which has also lapsed now. So those were two sort of specific things that I think the American public learned about Biden that they might not know, in addition to all of the personal things. It's always a personal touch to have your granddaughter sitting there and to have sort of those cute montage videos. I do think that what that Democratic pollster said is correct. I think people learned things about Biden that they didn't know. I certainly did as well.
Well, the Democratic Party platform in some places is even less progressive than Joe Biden's position on some issues. Like climate change, for example, Joe Biden set benchmarks that are years ahead of those in this current DNC document. But on issues like health care, you know, there's less movement. Karen, how did you see that platform in conjunction with the issues this election cycle?
You know, I have to say, I think that the platform ended up being much more on the back burner than it might have been in previous convention cycles. And I think that's because the Democrats and the Biden campaign are looking at this election as a choice between continuing 4 more years of President Trump or going in a new direction. And that new direction is, of course, policy related, but it's personal. And I think we saw that in President Obama's speech the other night, you know, saying that Joe Biden has the character and experience to make this a better country. He said he made me a better president. That's the emphasis on the personal side and the empathy side of Joe Biden. And I think we saw him say that so much last night. And that was his case against Donald Trump. We heard many people making it for Joe Biden over the course of the week. But to hear him say that, this is essentially about a direction for the country, it makes that case there. I think the Democrats are recognizing this moment that, yes, people do want to hear a litany of policy proposals. Joe Biden, though, has been in politics for decades. You kind of understand his policy perspective. I think people are looking for the change right now from the climate of the Trump presidency to something else. And we heard Joe Biden say that last night, that he would bring in something that is more hopeful and less divided.
Well, the Democratic convention in the books. Republicans have their turn next week. Their convention, of course, begins next week, so stay tuned for that. Let's move now to a federal indictment against President Trump's former chief White House strategist, Steve Bannon. Bannon and three business associates were charged essentially with a fraudulent shell game, stealing from a private enterprise set up to raise money for Donald Trump's border wall. Investigators from Donald Trump's own Justice Department say Bannon skimmed $1 million for his personal use. on this. Bannon is accused, Laura, of essentially defrauding the voter base that he and President Trump built, Laura.
That's right, Jane. So Bannon's indictment is also a part of a pattern within the Trump administration, which is either close advisors, people who used to work at the White House, people who have a direct ear to Trump, and potentially Trump's children as well, profiting off of the administration or their ties to the administration. And what's also striking in this is that some video surfaced yesterday. I believe CNN was the one who found it, but of Donald Trump Jr. being involved with the organization that Bannon had propped up. The organization was called We Build the Wall, at a 2018 event, at a 2019 event. And Donald Trump Jr.'s spokespeople tried to say he was only involved at one event. That was it. That was the extent of it. But this shows a connection between people who used to be in the White House, children of the president, pushing organizations that then stand to benefit from their ties to the White House.
Here is President Trump reacting yesterday to the arrest of Steve Bannon, his longtime advisor. He said he had disapproved of Bannon's crowdfunding campaign for the construction of the border wall.
I think it's surprising, but this was something, as you know, just by reading social media and by reading whatever it is, and by speaking to Mike and all of them, I didn't like that project. I thought that was a project that was being done for showboating reasons. I don't know that he was in charge. I didn't know any of the other people either. But it's sad. It's very sad.
President calling it a sad day. White House correspondent Karen Travers, what do you make of these charges here?
You know, and that's a pattern from the president right there to essentially say, I don't know anything about these people. I don't know anything about this project. I have nothing to do with this. Now, the president had in the past signaled that he didn't like this, that he didn't think the idea of a private funding for a wall was a good thing, that it would interfere with the government work. But I think it's striking that Steve Bannon's federal indictment yesterday makes him the sixth person associated with the top tier of President Trump's 2016 campaign to face federal charges. I mean, this is quite a list. You now have Bannon, Roger Stone, Michael Flynn, Rick Gates, Paul Manafort, and Michael Cohen. And in all of those cases, the president tried to distance himself from who those people were, the role they played in his campaign, and what they did. It's a hard argument to make, but the president has certainly tried to do that.
Well, there was another important legal development this week. Yesterday, a federal judge in New York said President Trump must turn over his tax returns to a Manhattan prosecutor who is investigating the president's business conduct and his personal finances. Liz Landers, this is a grand jury case. This is with the same judge who adjudicated the original case. You know, what's the significance of this? President Trump has been fighting this for a long time.
Yes, I think that's the first thing to remind listeners of is President Trump said on the campaign trail in 2016 that he would release his tax returns, and he never has. And there have been a number of excuses and reasons over the years. Reporters have asked him about this, and it has gotten to the point where it's now being litigated because there are people, especially in New York, you mentioned the Manhattan DA, Cy Vance, who wants to see these tax returns because of hush money payments in the 2016 campaign. So President Trump has kind of set himself up for this. When you say you're going to release something and then you don't, he's now facing all of these legal issues around it. And what happened this week is this case has now made it to the Supreme Court. And we found out that this judge in New York said that Trump must turn over those tax returns so that the DA there, Cy Vance, can continue to investigate this, and that the president doesn't get broad immunity. That's something that his lawyers have been arguing for years now, that because he's the president of the United States, he has special executive privilege and broad immunity from turning over his personal returns because all of this would be politicized in the current environment. And this judge is saying that is not the case and you must turn these over.
And President Trump, Karen Travers, said originally this was a fishing expedition, right? And the judge yesterday made specific reference to that, saying, no, this is not. How did you see this development?
Yeah, and no surprise that the president kept up with that. You know, he has argued he has immunity against this subpoena. The Supreme Court had said he does not have immunity from state criminal investigations. But the president, when he was asked about this yesterday in the Oval Office on Thursday, he said, we'll probably end up back at the Supreme Court. He's again dismissing this legal battle, continuing to call it a political witch hunt. And I think sometimes you see the president fall back on lines like that when it's just something he doesn't want to engage on, whether it was Robert Mueller's investigation, whether it was any of the congressional Democrats' investigations into a wide range of his business dealings or political dealings. The president just says, fishing expedition, witch hunt, nothing there, move on. So again, yesterday, the president dismissing this, saying his interpretation is he doesn't have to do this, and he wants to continue this legal fight.
So it's likely to end up again in the Supreme Court. But Liz, do we expect any revelations, well, say, before the election?
I don't think so, no. And I might be wrong, but are they hearing this case before the election?
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I'm asking you. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they are. So I would not expect to see anything before November. And there, I would also point out that there have been a number of cases that the court has decided to hear after the November elections. Another one of those is in relation to the Affordable Care Act. So the court is staying very far away from politics before November.
Elizabeth Landers, Vice News, Laura Barone Lopez, Politico, Karen Travers, ABC News. Stick with us. We are discussing the week in the news, and up next, the coronavirus pandemic on college campuses and the post office under scrutiny on Capitol Hill today. Much more to come. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. On Monday, the spotlight swivels to the opening night of the Republican National Convention. How does the presidential race look from your community? Did you vote for President Trump in 2016? Will you vote for him again? Why or why not? We'd love to hear your story at 617-353-0683. Back to our Week in the News roundup today. We've been discussing a busy week in the news with a fantastic panel. ABC News White House correspondent Karen Travers, Laura Barone Lopez, national political reporter at Politico, and Elizabeth Landers, D.C. correspondent for Vice. Well, the controversy over the Postal Service delays and a potential impact on the election continued this week as more than 90 House Democrats called on the Postal Service Board of Governors to immediately remove Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. President Trump expressing anger that members of his own party are calling on DeJoy to testify before Congress, which is happening today. Laura Barone Lopez, what is Mr. DeJoy answering for on Capitol Hill?
So DeJoy is answering for not only the delays, but also the decisions made to pull machines, pull the postal machines that allow people to either cast their ballot or just put their mail in boxes. He's pulled a lot of these out of cities, out of states. And so Democrats are demanding answers as to why there are all these backlogs, why There are boxes being taken out of circulation, being taken out of cities. And DeJoy so far today appears to be saying that it's a false and unfair narrative and that he's trying to work in an efficient and effective manner, given the cost of what it takes to run the USPS. There was also some changes, a kind of undetected nationwide rule change that was made this summer by the USPS, which I expect Democrats will ask him about as the hearing goes on throughout the day. But the rule change is that postal workers are now unable to sign absentee ballots for voters, which in the past they've had the authority to do. And so that could impact rural voters in particular. Mm.
Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General, today in the Senate hearings repeated claims that any changes he has made so far have only been made to make the Postal Service financially solvent. Karen, where do we stand on backlogs and mail-in ballots? A lot of Americans in this moment, rightly so, a little anxious mm-hmm. about whether their ballots will be counted or received.
Absolutely, because you're seeing states across the nation expanding mail voting options because Americans are expressing concerns about going to the polls, voting in person during the coronavirus pandemic, and they want to have more options. So this is happening in states where Republicans control the voting as secretaries of state. And we've seen warnings then that it's almost every state plus the District of Columbia that could experience some delays because of these changes that have been made to the U.S. Postal Service. You know, I think it's interesting when you look at how the president is talking about this. You know, earlier in the program, we talked about that big message from Democrats this week about having a plan for voting and not just go vote, but think about how you're going to do it. If we see any sort of message like that next week during the RNC from the president and his supporters, it's going to be vote in the way that we're going to tell you how to vote. And for the president, that's in person. He's tweeted many times, you know, if you can protest in person, you should vote in person. And Jane, he's taken significant issue with mail-in voting, despite the fact that he himself and his wife, the First Lady, will be doing absentee voting. He says there's a difference there. He doesn't think that states should be sending ballots out to registered voters. He thinks it's fine, though, if you're requesting one for yourself because you can't go and vote in person. So we've talked to a lot of experts over the last couple of weeks because this is something that happens a lot on my beat because the president talks about this so much. And experts are warning, yes, there could be a slowdown with ballots because of the Postal Service delays. They're also saying that there's just no evidence that increasing voting by mail will lead to widespread fraud. And Jane, that's something the president is hammering as a message.
Well, thank you all for that. Let me move now to the coronavirus pandemic, because coronavirus is spreading across college campuses. 17 states now have colleges with COVID cases. Nationwide, more than 1,000 cases reported on campuses. Michigan State, Notre Dame, University of North Carolina announced they will cancel in-person classes this fall. Liz Landers, the fact that outbreaks on college campuses have happened at the level and the speed of the past week, I have to say, is quite sobering.
It is, but it's not surprising. And I think I've seen some statements from a number of college presidents who've said that they figured that there would be clusters within their communities, but that they were surprised that they happened so quickly. So I think these universities understood that if they were reopening their doors for in-person learning, that there would be some cases of coronavirus, but the speed with which those clusters have emerged is surprising. And it's also, you know, reading stories where a lot of students are quoted in these pieces, it's disheartening for these students as well. And there are measures that I have even been surprised to see that have been implemented. I know at the University of Connecticut, there were students who were evicted from their dorm because they violated the rules on campus, where they had too many people in a residential hall getting together and having a get together or a party of some sort. That's a pretty strict measure, but this virus is highly contagious, and a university is the perfect place for it to spread. So I think that these colleges are trying to get a grasp of this before it gets even worse. And as you mentioned, some of these places have decided that they need to go online because there's no other way to safely have students on campus.
Here's Kelly Nash, a junior at the University of Notre Dame. She told Chicago's WGN News that after spending 5 months at home, she is ready to return to campus life.
We were expecting the school year to look a little bit different, but COVID spread quicker than we would have liked it to.
Well, a lot of people wondering, are we asking too much of these students coming back to college and not having a real college experience? So a lot of campuses dealing with this issue right now and into the fall. This week, also broadly speaking, 20 states report a decline in new coronavirus cases. But the lagging indicator is the death count. And 18 states still reporting more deaths right now compared to a week ago. Laura, after the summer surge, the question is, where are we heading, right, as we move into fall?
Mm-hmm. No, that's a really good question, Jane. And I don't think many people have the answer. There are concerns heading into the fall that different elements could exacerbate the coronavirus, right? Which is, it's colder weather. And so there could be more people indoors clustered together. There's also flu season. And that means that a lot of health officials are urging people to make sure you get your flu shot, because if you get the flu on top of potentially getting coronavirus, that's very lethal and deadly. And so there's a lot of education programs going on right now around that. I've spoken to health directors in Milwaukee that say that they're trying to amp up their outreach in terms of, please go get your flu shot, because trying to protect the populace as much as they can. In terms of the danger for younger kids, kids in college, and kids even younger than that, 18 and below, I think a lot of the issues at the colleges are also the same issues that superintendents and school boards are having with K through 12 students, which is a lot of them have told me that the lack of a national plan and national guidance really hinders them. Everyone is scrambling for the resources that they can get to prepare children. And again, the disproportionate impact that we've seen on Black and Latino and Native American people, adults, in their contraction of the virus and hospitalizations. A CDC report just came out recently that said that those same disparities are occurring among Black and Latino children.
Well, and a study published yesterday in the Journal of Pediatrics says children up to the age of 22 are much more likely to be, quote, silent spreaders than previously believed. And infected kids had significantly higher levels of the virus than even adults who were hospitalized in the ICU. So a lot of school teachers in several states threatening to strike if they're forced to go back. It's a hard situation. It's hard to know what to do. The clock is ticking. I want to get to a bipartisan Republican-led Senate report that was released this week that said President Trump's 2016 campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, posed a grave counterintelligence threat during the campaign. Here is Senator Mark Warner, a Democrat from Virginia, serving on the Intelligence Committee, speaking to NPR's Mary Louise Kelly. He said the 1,000-page document offers warnings for this election.
I'm still very worried, though, that if a foreign entity, if Russia wanted to advertise on Facebook, they could do so without disclosing who they are. Or if a foreign service, a foreign government, wanted to offer dirt on an opposing candidate to a presidential campaign, there's no obligation to tell the FBI as opposed to saying thank you. So I worry that we're not as safe as we should be, knowing that there are foreign governments that want to intervene.
So the Senate Intelligence Committee worked for 3.5 years on this. It's the only bipartisan examination of Russian interference in the 2016 election. And there are warnings as we look forward to the November election. Karen Travers, what's the difference in these findings from the special counsel's report that was past released?
Yeah, it did go further than what Robert Mueller did in detailing some of the ties between the Trump campaign and them being receptive to Russia's interference in the 2016 election. This report declared that the campaign had repeated contacts with Russian operatives. It described several different episodes in which the president and members of his campaign seemed eager, keen to accept help from Russia. Important note, though, there was no alleged criminal conspiracy between the president and members of his team and Russia. But Paul Manafort, the Trump campaign chairman, as you say, represented a grave counterintelligence threat, according to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And they looked at his ties with somebody the committee described as a Russian intelligence officer, Konstantin Kalimnik. There was concerns that maybe Manafort was involved in the Russian effort to hack the emails from the Democrats during the 2016 cycle. Those emails, of course, later published by WikiLeaks. Jane, I think it's interesting that this was such a big headline in Washington this week. As you say, 3.5 years in the making for this report. And we didn't hear a lot about this at any point during the DNC. Not just specifically this report, but, you know, kind of the issue of Russia and the Trump campaign and corruption and Ukraine. Remember earlier this year, that big story we were all covering of the impeachment? It's amazing to think that that's not even being mentioned now as part of Joe Biden and the Democrats' message against President Trump, that there's so many other crises that they can point to. But still, this was a very significant report, and it's a very big deal as there are still big concerns about election security this fall.
And Liz Landers, real quick here, a lot of the president's supporters say, okay, here we go again. More witch hunt. Why does this report matter?
Well, the report matters for a number of reasons that Karen pointed out. I would say when, as you mentioned, the president's supporters talk about this, they always, always emphasize the fact that there was no collusion found. And that is the case. There was nothing drawn directly, but there are a lot of details in here that raise eyebrows. There's a lot of, in this report, in the Senate report specifically, the intelligence committee says how difficult it was to get information out of the Trump administration and out of the Trump transition team. They used all kinds of ways to not give information over to the committee. So there's a real lack of transparency, too, in the way that this administration has responded to this, which I think begs the question of, you know, were they trying to hide things? Why weren't more of the people interviewed more forthcoming in the Mueller investigation, as Karen said, because there were many points in here that were new points that were a revelation to all of us, I think.
Well, let's wrap up here. Circle back to sort of where we began with the Democratic National Convention, which wrapped up last night. Republicans get their turn next week. Laura, what are you expecting to see?
So Republicans were taking a bit of notes as they were watching the DNC convention this week. We know that they're still making last minute changes all the way up until the end. What I'm curious about is Trump appears to want to have his own testimonial, similar to the people that we heard from that either had interactions with Biden or gave reasons for why they're going to vote for Biden. And so one of the couples that we are going to hear from is actually the St. Louis couple that brandished their guns at BLM protesters. It went viral. And so I think it'll be a very different tone at the RNC, one that likely pulls from what we've heard from Trump in the last month, which is this scare tactics essentially to tell particularly white suburbia that if Biden wins, then your way of life will be destroyed. And it's something that we've heard repeatedly from him.
Karen Travers, in our last minute here, some of the main speeches will take place at the White House. What are you expecting?
Yeah, the First Lady will be in the Rose Garden. The president will be on the South Lawn. And Jane, I think we can't forget that the president, before all of this, was a television producer. And he is going to take a keen interest in what this production looks like. And the Democrats set a high bar that was very complicated to pull together on short notice and to do it all remotely like that. And they had very few hiccups. The president says he wants to have more live elements to his convention next week. That's a really tall order. And we know the president has not been shy about publicly complaining after an event if he doesn't like how it looked or felt. So pay attention to what he's saying Monday and Tuesday, his reviews of his own convention.
And Liz, you get the last word on this. What do you see ahead?
Well, I am interested to see how they fold in some of these, you know, non-politicians into the mix. I think that the Democrats did that well this past week, had personal testimonies from people. I know Laura mentioned that couple from St. Louis. They're also going to invite people like Nick Sandman, who was the young man from Covington High School who approached that Native American man in front of the Lincoln Memorial, kind of became a hero for cancel culture. They're also going to have Andy Pollack, whose daughter died in Parkland. So I'm interested to see how they fold in some of these other non-political voices, like the Nikki Haley's, like the Joni Ernst, the Tim Scotts, who are going to speak into how those people see the Republican Party moving forward.
Well, we shall see, and we will be watching. A fast-moving hour today, lots of news to get to, and you all helped us understand it so nicely. Liz Landers, D.C. correspondent for Vice. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
Laura Barrón-López from Politico. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
And Karen Travers, White House correspondent at ABC News. Karen, thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Listeners, thanks you. Thanks to you. Have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.